Hello and welcome to Virtues of Peace. My name is Hope Elizabeth May, and I'm joined by Taylor Ackerman, Michael Buzzy, Randy Olson, and a very special guest dialing in from The Hague, the Netherlands, Stephen van Hoogstraten, who was the former director of the Carnegie Foundation of the Netherlands. He has also authored a book called New Challenges to International Law, A View from The Hague, and that is published by Brill. And thank you, Stephen, for being here. Happy New Year.
Happy New Year to you. Well, it still has to happen with us in a few hours' time.
Right.
But yes, this is the last day of the year.
This is the last day of the year. It's been an amazing year, a difficult year, and we are so honored to have our last show of this year of Virtues of Peace with you. It's not insignificant indeed. So let's just get into it. And again, if you're listening, our show resources page has a number of show resources that we will be referring to throughout the show. And that is at virtuesofpeace.com. But as I mentioned, Stephen, you were the former director of the Carnegie Foundation of the Netherlands. We're going to talk about that in a second, what that is. But just to give you an idea of where we are going with today's show, the title is The Blossoming Seed, The Pacific Settlement of Disputes and the 1899 Hague Peace Conference. And we have talked a lot on this show about the 1899 Hague Peace Conference, the Peace Through Law movement, Bertha von Suttner, the Peace Palace, Andrew Carnegie. But we really have not done a show focused on, well, what was the 1899 Hague Peace Conference and what happened and in what way has it blossomed into where we are today with our international machinery? And in particular, the United Nations, and as Stephen, I think you'll discuss, the Hague is has a number of international courts in it. It's known as the International Capital of Peace and Justice. So our objective today is to just sort of get the story out about what happened in 1899 in the Hague, and even a little bit before then, because it didn't come out of nowhere. And just to get this down via a conversation with one of the experts on this, who is Stephen van Hoogstraten. So Stephen, can you talk a little bit about the Carnegie Foundation of the Netherlands? What exactly is it, and like, how did it come to be?
Thank you, Hope. Well, the Carnegie Foundation came into being after the 1899 Peace Conference, and notably after the decision had been made to house the Permanent Court of Arbitration a bit better, a bit more international than they were housed at the time. So there was an initiative to build a more iconic building, and nobody had the money for that. Mm. An approach was made from several countries, but especially the Americans and the Dutch, to get Andrew Carnegie to donate a sum of money to build such a temple of peace or a temple of international law. Mm. And that happened. So when Carnegie, Andrew Carnegie, who was a staunch advocate of arbitration, by the way, very interested in international peace matters, when he was so far that he wanted to donate a sum of money of $1.5 million, which compares to an enormous amount of money nowadays, but I won't go there. Mm-hmm. A sort of structure had to be found to receive the money and to do all the work, and that was the Carnegie Foundation. Mm-hmm. The Carnegie Foundation was basically a trust created by Carnegie himself in the Netherlands and run by Dutch sort of senior people from government. Mm-hmm. to create the Peace Palace and later to be the owner and to be the management authority, and in that capacity to also be the host to the international institutions that work in the palace.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, thank you for that. So Carnegie gave this money, $1.5 million. I believe it was in 1903 that he gives the money. And you can actually go on to our show resources page at virtuesofpeace.com and the actual, you know, deed of gift, which is a very beautiful document, actually. It's a kind of artistic, calligraphic rendering of the deed of gift. You can read the deed of gift on our show resources page. But you said he gives this money to build this iconic building. Carnegie was a huge fan of arbitration. And what exactly was this Temple of Peace for?
The Temple of Peace to be built mm-hmm. was to house the Permanent Court of Arbitration, which mm-hmm. was the main product mm-hmm. of the 1899 Peace Conference in The Hague, mm-hmm. and which carried a lot of hope. So it should mm-hmm. have a building that really radiated something. Mm-hmm. And at the same time, there should be a library of international law. So mm-hmm. not only should there be the judges or arbiters, but also all the knowledge. And those two together worked well to provide the best basis for international justice.
Mm. So, right, the Permanent Court of Arbitration is really the cardinal achievement of the 1899 yeah. Hague Peace Conference. And as we will, I hope we get this out in this show. It's difficult to do so because there's a lot there's a lot to get yeah. out. But this was like a total paradigm shift, a new world order, if you will. At least some people thought so. I mean, others thought that the Hague Peace Conference was really nothing special, and it was, you know, sort of hypocritical, and nothing serious came out of it. But Carnegie was not one of those. And so, yeah, I think it's fascinating that he, an individual and an American, is the one who sort of comes forward and gives the money to build this Temple of Peace and the library. And I just want to point out that, you know, that's in 1903 that he gives the money. As you point out, Stephen, the Permanent Court of Arbitration is one of the main outcomes of the 1899 Hague Peace Conference. And there was a building. So the Permanent Court of Arbitration was like, it did have a building, but it was nothing special. It was yeah. it was not symbolic. Can you just talk about that a little bit?
Well, the Permanent Court of Arbitration, which we call PCA by its abbreviation, the PCA was housed in a regular but a very nice house in The Hague, but not for that was not for a large office. Was small at the time, and it had no visibility. Mm-hmm. And the idea was that this new instrument of arbitration should also be seen to be important. And that, I think, is what was behind the in the back of the minds of those who were asked to create a building. Mm. Because, you know, the Peace Palace didn't just come there because there was an existing plan. Mm-hmm. Once the money had been transferred, an architect's competition was organized in, I think, among the leading architects in the countries that had participated in the conference. And more than 200 submissions were received. Mm. And they were all sort of grandiose in their own right. And then the one by the French architect, Louis Cornonier, was finally chosen, first by a jury, and then there was other people involved. But finally, the Carnegie Foundation had to make a decision, and they chose the presentation and the plan mm-hmm. of Louis Cordonnier, mm-hmm. which is indeed, it looks a bit like a castle. Of course, mm-hmm. I don't know if you have a picture for your listeners, but I don't think your listeners will see many pictures. So, but it's a very nice building, and it looks a bit like a small castle.
Mm-hmm. Right. So this, yeah, is a process of coming into being, and there's so much involved in, you know, this paradigm shift. You agree that we're going to create a court. It starts operating in a building. But there's a felt need to make the building properly symbolic. It was Andrew Dixon White and really Fyodor Martins who really, and maybe Tobias Osser, who felt that this will not do to have it just in a kind of normal house. And I think that's extremely important. I want to connect that to your role, Stephen, and how you and I met, which was in 2013, which was the 100th anniversary of the Peace Palace. Such an important time. And I just want to acknowledge like what you did, because you really helped. You're helping with this story, not only like being here today, but I saw during the centenary, you know, a real conscious effort to make the story more known. And that is exactly why Andrew Dixon White wanted Andrew Carnegie to give this money, because if there's not something properly symbolic, then the people will not know. And this is actually, I'm pretty sure on our show resources page, there's a link to the Wikipedia page on the Peace Palace. And you can read it there that Andrew Dixon White basically, in one of his letters says, if you don't give the money, no one's going to know what has happened here.
Yeah.
And the other thing that I've learned from reading about this conference is that the press was not allowed into the plenary sessions.
They had to wait out. They had to wait outside.
And so this was something that was decried by Bertha von Suttner, who we'll talk about later. Yeah. So there's so much sort of obfuscation and like sort of like not publicizing this. And I just want to acknowledge, Stephen, you know, some of the things that you did during the centenary, which is hard to believe, 7 years ago in 2013, August 28th. You ushered in the building of the visitor center. So now there's like a sort of center where you can go. It's not in the Peace Palace, but you can go. And can you talk a little bit about the visitor center?
Yeah, Hope, the visitors, we had two main building projects in my time at the palace. And the second one was the visitor center. And that was created on the sort of on the finding that there were so many tourists coming to the Peace Palace in their buses every day, especially in the period between early April and late October. And they were landing on the little square in front of the palace, and they were jumping out, making a few pictures. And we said, well, we should be able to give them some background about what the Peace Palace is and what is going on there. What are these institutions doing? And what is the place of the Peace Palace in The Hague of today? Where do you find other international institutions? And so that was the leading idea to provide public information to the tourists that led us to create a small but a nice building on the edge of the ground. And it's on the grounds of the palace, so it's not on the public street. So you need to go through a gate. And at the same time, it forms a unity with the gate, so it is at a distance from the palace itself. But I think it's very successful. It was done by a British architect, and not only the building by the architect, but also the interior. We had, of course, it's an enormous challenge to catch 100 years of Peace Palace and the work of the institutions and of everyone involved in a number of shots or a number of affiche or so there was limited space to present it all, but I think it has been done. It has been a good success, and it is visited by many of the tourists. That was a very nice project to do, and we were helped by the city, we were helped by the Ministry of Foreign Affairs, and we had money from a foundation. So it was also nice to see that it was funded from other sources than the public sources.
I think it does a great job in helping to educate the public about this history, which still is really not known by most people. So I want to thank you and stress how important that is. And the other thing I want to draw attention to before we start talking about, well, what is arbitration and so forth, is you, when the Peace Palace turned 100, you oversaw the installation of the first ever actual woman statue bust in the Peace Palace, and that's Bertha von Suttner. And can you talk about that?
Yeah, well, when we prepared for the centenary, we felt we should have a few really focal points. Now, one of the focal points clearly was the date on which the palace was opened, 100 years, so that was the 28th of August. Mm-hmm. And another one was to highlight the work of Bertha von Suttner, mm-hmm. who had been so instrumental in getting the ideas across about arbitration or mediation as an alternative for sending the armies and going to war. And so, in fact, we had enough money to have two of those busts made. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. We had a winner, and the winner is in the Peace Palace, and the other one was given to us by us to the city of The Hague, mm-hmm. who is so happy to be a city of peace and justice. Mm-hmm. So, we had a committee, and we had various plans proposed to us, and we had a sort of budget in mind, and the winner developed the bust, first in clay and then later, of course, in bronze. Mm-hmm. And we were involved. Sometimes we went to the atelier to see how the work was progressing, and it was a very nice moment on the 28th of August, 2013, to see that one of the female Nobel winners, Laimak Bawi, mm-hmm. from Liberia, I think, mm-hmm. that she unveiled this statue in the hall of the Peace Palace. Mm-hmm. And in fact, she was and is the first lady of the Peace Palace. There's one other lady that also has a bust, mm-hmm. And that is a very well known Dutch person, mm-hmm. Aletta Jacobs, but that would be too far in detail to explain who she is. But Bertha von Suttner is our number one lady, and her work is very much is very much appreciated and recognized. Mm-hmm. In fact, her book, which is called The Waffennieder, mm-hmm. that is a German word for lay down your arms. The Waffennieder has been retranslated in Dutch, in modern Dutch, so that it would read easily. And that was a recent project by, I think, the Carnegie Foundation, and more in particular, its library.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, right. And so in addition to just like this education, like, so you have the visitor center, and that's uncovering this history, but also this more detailed uncovering by the installation of the bust. So there's so many different layers and pieces to this history that's so important. And we have stressed on this show repeatedly that really, like, the individuals involved in the 1899 and subsequent Hague Peace Conference in 1907 are full of what we call moral energy, and they're very, you know, worthy to be studied and have an encounter with. So again, I want to thank you for that. And I just want to open it up to the other hosts on the show to see if they have any questions. And just remember to unmute, and I see Randy, go ahead.
Yeah. I'd like to ask Stephen a framing question. Because, you know, we've mentioned a number of times that The Hague is the city of peace and justice, and we've, you know, I've never really gotten a good explanation as to how or why the Netherlands happens to be this epicenter of, like, peace and justice through the world. And so could you help me understand, like, why the Netherlands for all of these things?
I will try to give you an explanation. It's the best explanation I have. Maybe others will frame it in a different way. But clearly, it all starts with the two peace conferences in The Hague of 1899 and 1907. That was the initiative of the Tsar, and the Tsar had a family relation with the Queen of the Netherlands, called Wilhelmina. And the Dutch were a neutral country, so they were not a major power. And they were easily accessible. So those three elements made that the question was asked to the Queen, could the conference be held in The Hague? And in fact, she agreed after consulting the cabinet, and she even offered her own palace for the first conference, and it so happened. And from then on, there were at least two major international institutions of law in The Hague. The first one I mentioned, the Permanent Court of Arbitration. But after the First World War, with all its atrocities, it was felt that arbitration was no longer good enough. It was good, but not good enough. So they created, the countries in the world created a Permanent Court of International Justice, the forerunner of the International Court of Justice, which, as you know, is one of the main organs of the United Nations, and that still sits in the palace. So the palace is clearly there for the UN International Court and for the arbitration, those two. And then around that developed a little infrastructure, the Iran-US Claims Tribunal was located in The Hague. And then the question was asked, where should the International Tribunal for Yugoslavia, for the former Yugoslavia, where should it go? And that's where an important man came in. He was the Secretary General of the United Nations, Mr. Boutros Ghali. And Mr. Boutros Ghali had come often to The Hague because he was an adept of the Hague Academy of International Law. I didn't yet mention that, but that is also an interesting branch of the activities in The Hague. So he knew The Hague, and he said, no, let's do it in The Hague, which he considered to be the judicial capital of the world, judicial meaning institutions. And then when, after that, there were negotiations about an international criminal court, you may know those negotiations were finalized in Rome, the candidacy of the Netherlands for the headquarters of the International Criminal Court were easily accepted because many people already knew The Hague. They had gone to the academy or they had gone to the Institute of Social Studies. So that is the sort of explanation that I can give you, that it was a build-up, it was a step-by-step, but it all started 100 years ago and it has developed. But the development was helped also by the fact that there was an annual get-together of the best students and the best professors in the Hague Academy of International Law, because that provided the sort of fertile background.
That's perfect.
Thank you.
Yeah, and I'd like to add to that, if I may, and then I'll open it back up to see if anybody else has questions about, you know, this, why the Netherlands, why The Hague, and just general questions about, you know, this place, the Peace Palace. So you mentioned Boutros Ghali, who had been familiar with The Hague and familiar with the Hague Academy of International Law, which is one of the institutions in the Peace Palace. But I also, I'll get back to that in a second, but I also want to draw attention to the Hague Conference on International Private Law.
Absolutely.
Which was, I believe, 1893, the same year that The Kingdom of God is Within You is published in Germany, I believe. But that's how I remember that date. But the Hague Conference on International Private Law was organized by Tobias Osser, extremely important individual to international law, and a Dutchman himself. And I remember reading, maybe it's in Arthur Eifinger's book on the 1899 Hague Peace Conference, that Osser was quite good friends with Fyodor Martens. And Martens had come to the 1893 Hague Peace Conference and was quite taken with The Hague and really liked just the sort of the aesthetic of it. And it was really like the kind of connection between Osser and Martens made at the 1893 Hague Peace Conference that helped to pave the way for Martens to say, hey, to the czar or comp Europe. I don't know who's in charge of the location, but I think that also helped. And that story is that's sort of like repeated with your story of Boutros Ghali, that, well, he had been to The Hague, he knew of this, and it's sort of like, you know, using that history and building on it. And I think that's extremely important, this point here that, you know, you got to start somewhere and it starts there. And I'd say Tobias Osser has a lot to do with why The Hague
He's, I think, the only person in the Netherlands to ever have been awarded the Nobel Peace Prize.
That's my understanding as well.
A copy of that Nobel Peace Prize is in the visitor center. Can I just add one element to your story about the Hague Conference on Private International Law? It was, I think it's entirely true. It was earlier than the Hague Peace Conference, and the Martens had seen that The Hague was quite capable of receiving a large group of people and was quite capable of doing this. Incidentally, my father has been working for a long time as Secretary General of the Hague Conference on Private International Law. So that also makes me happy that you mentioned it. But now on Boutros, why was Boutros so impressed by international justice? He said, and I've heard that from him personally, he said, when I came to The Hague as a student of 21, student of international law, and I went to these courses of famous international professors, there was one thing that impressed me more, and that was to go to a public sitting of the court, so the Permanent Court of International Justice. He was seemed very impressed by that picture of a world court sitting in the Peace Palace doing an actual case. And he's said that to me a number of times, and that was one of his real motivations to see this strong connection to The Hague.
Wow. So he was a student of The Hague Academy?
Yeah.
Wow, that's amazing. So, and let's just, going back to this, like, what happens in 1899 with this Hague Peace Conference and this building of this first ever international court, the Permanent Court of Arbitration. I said before, this is a real paradigm shift. We'll get in, first we're just like getting out the place where this thing is. And as you mentioned, Stephen, like it was not just the courthouse, but also a library and this like knowledge piece. That's really important, the important part of Carnegie's gift. And so this paradigm shift not only needs a building, it needs a library, and we need to, you know, start to educate judges and parliamentarians and diplomats and students and lawyers about this is like a new era, and there's like this new court. And the Hague Academy on International Law, I mean, we could do a whole show on that, but again, like Tobias Oster, when he wins the Nobel Peace Prize, he uses that money to contribute to the Hague Academy on International Law.
He did that.
Yeah, so...
And so did, by the way, the Carnegie Endowment for International Relations, I think it's called.
Yeah.
The Carnegie Endowment gave a sum to get the academy started.
Yeah. And I believe it was Elihu Root who was we've talked about him on this show. And I'm just like there's all of these, you know, interconnecting threads, and it's all of these people coming together. And the Peace Palace really, you know, does symbolize that it's all of these different personalities, countries, organizations coming together to build towards this vision. And so anyway, we'll hopefully get to like how that leads to where we are today, but you've already said, you know, the Permanent Court of International Justice, which is the court of the League of Nations. And by the way, this year is the 100th anniversary of the League of Nations. And so that's really important. So the League of Nations goes into the Peace Palace. So, but the Peace Palace was not built for the League of Nations. It was built for the Permanent Court of Arbitration. So important.
I have seen in my time, and I've consulted the archives to understand why that was. But I think the Permanent Court of Arbitration had not developed in such a greatness that part of the palace was still available. and indeed, there were a few cases under arbitration, but there was simply room for more. And I think the League of Nations felt it a very good idea to establish this new court in the Peace Palace, in the other rooms. And they would use the same Great Hall of Justice, either for arbitrations or for the cases of the PCIJ, the Permanent Court of International Justice. It's only later that a separate building was added to house the judges, the 15 judges of the International Court of Justice. Nowadays there's a lot of sort of scramble for space because there's so much is happening and so many people need offices that various institutions are, are very interested in obtaining more.
Mm-hmm. The proverbial turf wars.
Well, as a former director, I will not use that word. I sort of understand it pretty well.
Right. So, you know, there's so much. And so we have the Permanent Court of Arbitration, 1899. We have the Permanent Court of International Justice, which is like 1920. And then we have 1922. And then the International Court of Justice, which is like 1946.
Okay. It started 1 year after the creation of the United Nations.
Mm-hmm. And that court, the International Court of Justice, is still in the Peace Palace.
Absolutely, yeah.
And they
they're very fond of the palace. They want to stay there.
Naturally.
But it's interesting to see that the rules that govern the International Court of Justice are the same rules that were designed for the Permanent Court of International Justice, or the League of Nations Court, mm-hmm. preceded in many, many ways the mm-hmm. International Court of Justice. That is why you will only have two languages. There's English mm-hmm. and there's French. And basically the French will say that the French language comes first because that was the language of the old days. But okay, these two languages are equal, but the other languages of the UN are not being used in the official procedures of the International Court of Justice. Mm-hmm. But also the whole structure of the court, the way they work, the way they are selected, is copy and paste, more or less, from what had happened in the 1920s. Mm-hmm. I find an interesting link to the arbitration. I think we should maybe also spend some time on arbitration. Mm-hmm. But the whole concept of arbitration is that two parties agree amongst themselves to submit a dispute to an outside force, sort of outside force. And that is reinforced in the court system. But still, you cannot just go to the court and say, I want to sue this or that country. Every country needs to accept the jurisdiction of the International Court of Justice first before they can declare themselves competent to hear the case. And that, in a way, is the same hurdle that you have to go over for arbitration.
Right. Yeah, we will talk about arbitration. We'll talk about that very soon. I just want to open it up to anybody else. I know, Randy, you had your question to see if anybody else. Taylor, go ahead. I see you're unmuting.
Yes. So one of the other things you mentioned was the Peace Palace Library. And I'm wondering if you could speak on sort of its expansion and how the importance of it being open to the public. I know that's been debated at various points. Just as like you opened up the visitor centers to the public, the importance of opening up sort of international law to the public.
Thank you, Taylor. The Peace Palace Library was always there in a part of the building, which was at the time good enough to have the books and to have a reading room. But it became clear in my time that this space was not enough and that we should anticipate an extension. And then the Ministry of Foreign Affairs of the Netherlands was kind enough to provide a budget. And on that basis, we have developed a plan for a new building next to the Peace Palace, quite a sizable building, which would house both the library and the Hague Academy of International Law. And I think that you have done some time in The Hague, so you know the building. It's a very lengthy one with a very large underground part where all the books are, and a very nice wing for all the for the study places. And yes, the library was always meant to be a public library, which becomes more and more difficult to operate because there's so much security also going on UN occupied places. But the whole idea was to see as many people from the public but interested in law come to the library and use its facilities. And in fact, the library has now gone in the age, of course, of the digital age. They provide services to their readers or to their students or professors. So they can basically stay at home and use the library because the library is stretching out from the palace. So you don't have to come to read your book at the table. You can just get all the information on your screen and do it at home. Is that an answer to your question?
Yes. Yes. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks. And Michael, did you have a question?
Yes, I did have a question. I was wondering if you could speak a little bit about what your overall tenure as director of the Carnegie Foundation of the Netherlands was like. Just from our discussion so far, it really sounds like some of your main initiatives were greater education and greater accessibility for the public to international law and to the Peace Palace. Would you say that would be an accurate characterization of what you were trying to accomplish?
I think I definitely wanted to accomplish a stronger public image of the Peace Palace and a working image of the Peace Palace. So stay away from the museum idea that you could have if you look at the building, but show what importance it had for world relations and for world peace. I've been there for 13 years, and I think first and foremost, I was the host in the palace. They called me the landlord, and it was a title that I was certainly a little proud of, because I was recognized in that role by the institutions that had to do their work in the palace that we took care of. Of course, there is a strong public image at the Peace Palace, so we had many international visitors. I remember that Putin came, and I remember that, of course, Secretary General of the United Nations came, or even the Queen of England has spent a half day in the Peace Palace. So that was a more protocolary part of my work. The more substantial work was to run its finances, and there's quite a bit of finances involved. So you have to be on your toes all the time to get enough budget. But the general gist was get the message out what is happening here and justify the fact that the world is calling The Hague the legal capital of the world. So I've done many things, and I now forget maybe a few. But the whole idea was not to stay on the inside, but to go out and show what we were doing.
That's so cool. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Yeah. So let's move on then to arbitration. And so one thing you said earlier before, Stephen, is, you know, this whole idea of two parties sort of agreeing to have their dispute adjudicated by a third party. This is the sort of like crucial move to, you know, surrendering to a dispute settlement mechanism. And I would like, Michael, since you just asked a question, we have here Article 33 of the UN Charter, and this is part of Chapter 6 of the UN Charter, which is titled the Pacific Settlement of Disputes. And that's, you were talking before about how the procedures of the International Court of Justice draw so much from the Permanent Court of International Justice, or the League of Nations Court lays the template for the UN Court. Yeah. And similarly, I can't help but think that the 1899 Hague Peace Conference and one of the treaties that comes out of that, called the Pacific Settlement of International Disputes, lays the groundwork for Article 33 of the UN Charter, which is titled the Pacific Settlement of Disputes. So Michael, can you read, this would be Section 1 of Article 33.
Yeah, it reads, the parties to any dispute, the continuance of which is likely to endanger the maintenance of international peace and security, shall, first of all, seek a solution by negotiation, inquiry, mediation, conciliation, arbitration, judicial settlement, resort to regional agencies or arrangements, or other peaceful means of their own choice.
Thank you so much. So there's a lot going on in that. So you're feel free to look it up.
It's pretty, now that I hear it again, it's pretty mandatory language. The parties shall do that. And I think that might be underlined in general terms a bit more, because the feeling is you have the possibility to submit to arbitration or to go to mediation. But here it sounds as if it was meant as a real obligation.
Interesting
to note that. And yes, the part that the Peace Palace is involved with is basically the last two words, arbitration and judicial settlement, arbitration by the PCA, judicial settlement by the International Court of Justice. Now, the PCA also has it in itself to do mediation or to do good offices or conciliation. It's all there, but it has not had a wide practice, I must admit. There's one very good example for the conciliation. That is the definition of the borderline between Australia and East Timor, because that has been done and developed in a conciliation committee that worked under the rules of the Permanent Court of Arbitration. And that, I think, was a pretty important piece of work, because there's so much interest involved, oil and other resources, that this borderline in the sea was of the greatest importance. But so I've always felt that mediation, as opposed to arbitration, is a chapter that The Hague could do more on. I think the UN is active, of course. They have a lot of political mediation, but that happens elsewhere. That does not happen in The Hague.
Yeah, I want to go back to your noting that the word shall is used in Article 33, and you're noting that's kind of important. And I want to, exclamation point, underline, highlight, circle, et cetera. And on this show, we have mentioned, I think I referred to it as Article 26. It's actually Article 27 of the 1899 Convention for the Pacific Settlement of Disputes. So this is the multilateral treaty that establishes the PCA, the Permanent Court of Arbitration. Now, Article 27 of that has a similar sort of like obligatory language. It says the signatory powers consider it their duty. So it doesn't say shall, but it's the same meaning. And I just want to say that when that article was proposed at the conference, and I didn't know this until recently, I shared this with you yesterday, Stephen, when we were talking, that Bertha von Suttner in her 1899 Hague diary talks about how this article came into being. And it was a sort of like really inspiring part of the conference. It was France, French delegates who proposed it. And they say things like, this is really huge because we are talking about international obligation in this article. And so you see the same thing with Article 33 of the UN Charter, uses shall. And so like, that's the paradigm shift, that there is this like international obligation to work for peace. And I want to say there's a blossoming seed there, that Article 33 is sort of like an echo of what we see earlier in Article 27 of the 1899.
Absolutely true. At the same time, we know that the world is not made up of only of people who aim for peace. And it has always struck me that in the early years of the existence of the PCA, war broke out here and there, and that the parties did not remind that duty to go to the Permanent Court of Arbitration. They just felt that the military should intervene.
Right.
and I was most struck by the example of the First World War, when Austria-Hungary presented its ultimatum to Serbia. Mm. Basically, they had framed it in such a way that Serbia could simply never accept it, and then they would give the alibi to send the troops. And Serbia said, well, there are 4 points that we cannot agree with. Let us go to The Hague for that. And Austria did not spend a day on that. And just one day later or so, they sent the army and they invaded Serbia. Mm. So that is, and Austria was, of course, an important partner in the whole peace business. But the military and the government were simply a lot stronger than those who aimed for the peaceful settlement.
Mm-hmm. Does anybody have anything to add to this thread about Article 33, its roots in Article 27, perhaps?
I'd like to make a brief comment on the subject of, you know, the court coming into existence, a permanent court of arbitration, and then the fact that wars broke out shortly afterwards. Because, you know, I've heard a number of times that it's like, well, the courts failed. The peace conferences, they weren't effective because war happened. And I feel like there's a bigger thing that's happening, right? Where there's this ideal that's being constructed and the machinery is being set in motion. And, you know, I recently learned that it takes like hundreds of years to build a cathedral. And to point out that like the carpenter at like day three forgot some of the boards is like, it's like missing the point. So I just wanted to, I feel like it's pretty straightforward, but like just because there was wars doesn't mean the peace conference wasn't a success.
Yeah. Well, I would entirely agree with that. I have exactly the same feeling that you cannot judge the success of this whole operation on a few examples. But what I think what we all should understand is that yes, the machinery is there. The way is cleared for a solution according to Pacific lines, but the countries involved still have to want it. They still have need to show the desire to resolve the dispute by peaceful means. I don't know if I still get a question about the war between the Boers and the UK. Which was very much was a matter of great interest for my country because the Boer War was fought by people who originally came from the Netherlands and who had great sympathy. And there were the arbitration was proposed. That was only a month after the conclusion of the first Hague Peace Conference. And simply nobody wanted to engage in arbitration, not on the UK side and not on the Boer side and not on the Dutch side. I think it was too political.
I just want to add to this conversation and, you know, the point that a few failures does not signify, you know, or a few mishaps does not signify total failure, indeed. And one thing that Bertha von Suttner repeatedly stresses, and we see it stressed again and again, as this machinery is being built, that part of like one of the ingredients for its success is knowing that it exists. So again, like Article 27, it's the duty to remind these powers that this exists. That's not sufficient, right? Because sometimes, as you're pointing out, Stephen, it's political, but also public. The public needs to know that it exists. And actually, Bertha says, look, you had these like different commissions at the 1899 Hague Peace Conference. There should have been a fourth commission on education. She says this. It's amazing. And so insofar as like we continue to be ignorant, that is just, you know, going to contribute to more carpenters forgetting their boards, if you will. And so that's a huge component. And that's, you know, what we try to do inch by inch through our dialogues. The public education piece is part of it. And so as long as people's imagination continues to be crippled by, you know, like I said, it's what it is. It's a crippling of the imagination, not knowing of like that this stuff exists, how long it's been being built and perfected. You know, you just don't think of it. And Bertha saw that during her time. You know, you mentioned Diwaf and Nieder, and she mentions that she has an encounter with a young man who's read her book at the 1899 Hague Peace Conference. I think it's the son of Baron Bildt. And he says, look, you know, like, I read your book and now I want to be an international judge. And before I read your book, I was going to like be a military man. And so,
Yeah,
it expanded his imagination. He broadened like what's possible. Yeah. And so that's why these stories are so important. Yeah. Anybody else want to add to this bit? Going once, twice, Michael.
Can I? I listened to the question. Then I would like to add another point.
Well, why don't you add your point, and then Michael, you can go ahead. Sound good?
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, you mentioned this 1899 convention on the creation of the PCA. That has been followed up by a new convention in 1907. Mm-hmm. Which replaced the old one from 1899. And I read that in preparation of this talk. And I found that in the 1907, there was reference to matters which were not belonging to the sort of national, national honor, I think. Mm. If a matter was in the sphere of your national honor, then you were not obliged to do all this because national honor was even stronger than the wish to do arbitration. I don't know whether you found that, and I remember reading about it by Bertha von Suttner, that everybody understood that if your national honor was at stake, then you would have to act in a different way. And many things can be attributed to the feeling of national honor, I'm afraid.
Yeah, that was my point. Yeah, indeed. Bertha decried that and saw that as, you know, a kind of loophole.
Yeah.
You know, as we say sometimes, it's the exception that swallows the rule. And she was very troubled by that. But Michael, did you have a follow-up to go ahead?
Yeah, I just wanted to say I really appreciated that conversation, the bit we were talking about before where, you know, I think people often, in my discussions with other individuals as well, because I'm still a student of this history. And so, you know, you discuss this and then they immediately point to the First World Wars, the most cataclysmic conflicts in human history. And they say, well, none of this stuff worked, so there's no point in continuing to do it. But I think framing it in the sense of the mechanisms are there, and it's really, you can't claim the mechanisms don't work if you're not using them. And I think that whole point of the parties involved did not even seek arbitration or want that as a resolution. And so then they went with war instead. And I think that bit of national pride is also something that we still see rearing its head today. I point to the recent Nagorno-Karabakh conflict between Armenia and Azerbaijan and the peace deal that was reached with Russia being the arbitrator and then Armenia foregoing the territory so there wouldn't be further bloodshed. And then the people are of Armenia are in an uproar and wanting the prime minister out because of this perceived wound to their national pride all of this.
Yeah, that's very, very visible. And incidentally, I've been part of the government for 25 years. It was before I came to the Peace Palace. I was a director in the service of the ministry. And I know how governments work. And I think it's no different in the US or in any other country. They define their interests in the best possible way and in the best political way. So You can't blame a government for taking a selfish line. Of course, from a distance, you can say, well, this was extremely stupid to do. But the Austrians simply didn't want to give any alibi to other minorities they would stall what they saw as a justified step. And we all know how non-justified it was, I must say, if you see all the incredible trouble that has come from that. But that is how governments work, I'm afraid.
I'm going to jump in here. You know, one of the words that keeps coming to my mind, which we haven't brought up today because it's one of these, you know, big ideas and we only have so much time, but it's this idea of a normative framework. And in the context of this conversation, it really seems like, you know, if we're going to evaluate the success of the peace conferences, I think that we have to look at these, this other thing, right? This framework, instead of like just A, B, or C examples. It's like, yeah. No. Like, so Stephen, my question is going to be, do you think that, you know, in this, from the standpoint of like the hearts and minds of people, the project of peace that's really taken place in The Hague has been moving in the right direction?
Thank you for the question. I think that absolutely yes. What is happening in The Hague in that period of a century now is moving in the right direction. We will need more time. We will need more conviction in a number of capitals. But there are so many examples where the mechanisms of peaceful settlement have worked and have led to a good result, also acknowledged by the parties involved, that I can give you no other answer than to say, yes, the machinery does work when it is used to its potential. And of course, if it's not used to its potential, I'll give you one more example. China is an enormous country. China has as its official policy that a conflict can never be resolved other than through negotiation. So they will simply never accept any rule above their head. They will never accept a third-party intervention from a theoretical point of view. But if you ask me, well, as to the area of criminal law, but there's a lot happening there too, and also in The Hague, something that the US the US government is maybe not so happy with, but we think it is a very worthwhile development.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. I mean, this framework of, you know, moving towards peace is something that it's like we can clearly see how in the 1899 Hague Peace Conference there was this big shift, and I'm really glad you've, you know, helped me understand it a little bit more clearly. This whole thing is, it's amazing to know that this particular little pocket of history is like a marked spot where like some kind of historical page gets turned, and now we're on this other path.
Well, I'm happy to hear that you see it that way too. Where do we stand in terms of time? I'm still totally available to you, but what is your plan?
Well, we can go for about 20 more minutes if that's okay with you.
That's fine. Yeah.
Okay. Well, good. So I think we're all in agreement that there's this progress being made and there's a framework that's being built, and it's, you know, inch by inch, piece by piece. And we've talked a little bit. I think the last show that we did was on December 10th, maybe, which was the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. We actually did a show on that. And of course, you know, that declaration that came out of World War II. And so that's also adding to this normative framework that we've been talking about. But I want to go back to Article 33 and all of these different ways to solve a dispute. You mentioned that negotiation is the only method that the Chinese will accept. We have negotiation, inquiry, mediation, conciliation, arbitration, and judicial settlement. And you've said, Stephen, that, you know, arbitration and judicial settlement are, these are the two different, arbitration, one, the Permanent Court of Arbitration, and judicial settlement, the International Court of Justice. Yeah. You've talked a little bit about the differences between those two methods, but can you just get a clear statement about it? Can you do that?
Yeah. If hope it is a question which is more difficult than you would think. I remember that when there were tourists in the palace, they would often ask, well, when do you go to arbitration and when do you go to the court? And our guides have great difficulty in giving the right answer. But even a law professor would find that difficult, because the two systems lead to the same result.
Mm.
But there's a main difference. In arbitration, you bring in a few of your own guys, and they meet of the other party, guys of the other party, and there's an independent leadership. In the case of the court, there is a bench. There are independent judges. There are, so if you go before the court, the risk of losing your case is probably greater than when you go to arbitration, where it's sort of close to your chest. There is a difference also in transparency. Arbitration is clearly a method of solving the dispute behind closed doors or behind the curtains. In the case of the International Court of Justice, it is very transparent. Every step is documented. Every step is in the public eye. And the judges at the end, they will consult and they will take a decision. And they will publicize that that decision, even with dissenting opinions, which often happens.
Mm-hmm.
So it is basically up to a government to decide whether to submit a question that it has with another country to arbitration, or that they will seek the adjudication by a court.
Mm-hmm.
So the whole step after the First World War to go from arbitration to this standing court, it was felt, I think, that arbitration was simply not good enough. It was voluntary, and the system of the court can bring more elements of discipline. Notably, that if your country says I want to abide by this court, then you cannot just backtrack the next day. And the whole idea was that if there's a network of countries that accept the rule of the ruling of this international court, then that will lead to a system of international justice. So I would say to have a standing court is simply a few steps more on the ladder of international justice.
Mm-hmm. Right. So arbitration, what I'm hearing is the parties who submit to that form of dispute settlement, sort of they have a say, or I would guess a greater say in who is deciding that. And so you said it's like, it's more risky if they submit it to judicial settlement. There is, I think, isn't there like a mechanism where if a party to a dispute adjudicated by the ICJ does not have a judge on the court, they can appoint an ad hoc judge?
So absolutely, that is a very actual rule. Mm-hmm. Indeed, there are 15 judges in the International Court of Justice, and the moment that a country is involved in a dispute before the court and they do not have a judge of their nationality in the court, they have the right to bring in an ad hoc judge. Mm-hmm. So you will have cases where you see not 15 judges, but 17, two ad hocs to go with the others. And I think it also comes from the old times that you want to be sure that the country feels involved and that mm-hmm. You're sure that they can bring out all the arguments of the country right until the last moment.
Mm-hmm.
Must be something of that kind. It dates back to the beginning of the Permanent Court of International Justice.
Mm. And you also mentioned conciliation. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, conciliation, verzoening in Dutch. I've always find it difficult to distinguish between conciliation and mediation. There are more or less two. It's the same procedure. You try to bring the parties with a little help to a point of view that they share. So it is very distinct from arbitration. I think that you should understand that. Arbitration is a decision by a panel. The panel has come forward in a certain way, but it's their decision and you have to abide by it because otherwise the system doesn't work. So the outcome of arbitration is binding. Mediation is no arbitration at all. There's no decision. It is the two parties which are brought on the same line or on the same wavelength by the mediator. I think that is the art of the mediator is to find the right ears in the two camps and sort of try to attune their views. I think that is what also the UN is doing in its political work. But conciliation is basically the same. In conciliation, there is more the acceptance of certain things that have gone wrong. So get the hate element out of it. But I'm not a true linguist, so maybe you can help me here by explaining where you see the difference between conciliation and mediation. But it's I'm sure it's two words for the same process.
Yeah, I mean, I've seen, so if this interests you, a listener, or the other hosts on the show resources page, we do have this this handbook. It's like the handbook on the Pacific Settlement of Disputes. And that's really useful. There's like different, you know, sort of like 3 to 5 page explanations on each of these different forms of nonviolent dispute. Yeah, it's so useful, actually. And they say in that handbook things like, it's not really clear, like you're saying, like conciliation, mediation. It's not really clear when one becomes the other, that one of the differences has to do with the role that the third party, the mediator, if you will, plays, that if it's like the mediator is like actually giving instructions versus guiding. And it's this very sort of, it's not exactly defined, but I also wanted to get out, you know, like inquiry and fact finding, is another, I think another part of conciliation.
I think fact finding is very important. If there is a trouble situation, I think both parties are helped a lot with proper fact finding by a committee or a few persons who cannot be disputed. I think fact finding is an important one in the list.
Yeah, and how about good offices is not mentioned in Article 33. Okay, but good offices, I believe you mentioned it before, and in any case, that's part of like during the 19th century peace movement, peace through law movement, where really like the focus is on arbitration, and you get conciliation shortly thereafter. But like arbitration and good offices are really these concepts that you see used quite a bit. And I was wondering if you could also talk about good offices, because that's a term that really drops out of Article 33, to my dismay, actually. Like, I think you should have all of this language in there to help, you know, trigger.
To be honest, I thought it was in, but
I don't see it.
Good offices is in the same field as mediation, so there's no binding element in. But I think good offices are offices by an international organization or by a state. And if you look into this old convention of 1899 and 1907, you will find that the idea of mediation there is to ask two countries not involved in the conflict to help out. So that is not one mediator who sits in Camp David, but it is two countries which feel one is a friend of the one party and the other is a friend of the other party, and they try to bring the matters forward. So it is an outside involvement by states. And I think those states can then offer good offices. They can propose maybe experts to help, or they can get involved in a certain way in a solution. I remember there was a big case in Latin America about a national park. I remember that a country like Colombia was involved, I think Venezuela, and that was solved on that basis. It was a big dispute about developing a natural forest, I think. And then two other countries came in. One of them was Brazil, and the fourth I have forgotten. And they managed to find a satisfactory solution. So it's in that sphere that I also see the word good offices. But maybe the document that you have from the UN explains a bit more about good offices.
Yeah, it does, actually. But it's not an Article 33. The other thing I wanted to say is, you know, like really what Article 33 of the UN Charter does, like again, negotiation, inquiry, mediation, conciliation, arbitration, judicial settlement, it's laying out what we in the United States and in our law schools, at least the law school that I went to, called ADR, also known as alternative dispute resolution.
Yeah.
And indeed, I remember like I wasn't really like when we think of like law and law school, we think, oh, you go to court, you know, you go to court. Yeah. It's judicial settlement. So even like our imaginations domestically in our like domestic legal systems is really, you know, it doesn't really focus on these other things like good offices, mediation, and so forth. And so again, like that's part of this project that we're trying to create. So anybody else want to add to this bit about, you know, these differences, good offices, mediation, conciliation, and all these different, you know, ways to go about solving a dispute that does not necessarily involve, you know, taking your case to a permanent court.
I'll make a brief comment. You know, it's something we talked about on a previous show, but you know, Carnegie makes the point very clearly that, you know, you can't be a judge in your own case, and so like as a civilization, we're trying to create the means through which we can actually solve problems if we're not going to just decide that might makes right.
Yeah. Stephen, do you want to speak to that?
Sorry, I maybe didn't get the question or the point. There was a little crack in the system. So could Randy give his question again?
It was more of a comment. I was referring to something that Andrew Carnegie said, which is that you know, you're not allowed to be a judge in your own case. And so, you know, I was just painting the broad frame that, like, okay, so how do we go about resolving things? And, you know, we've got all these different methods, right? The good offices, the mediation.
But it all comes down to the by a state institution to surrender sovereignty in order to get a solution that's broken away from the European Union. And they have only just 2 days ago concluded an agreement on the new trade system, and the dispute settlement in that agreement between the UK and us, the Europeans, is to settle disputes by arbitration, because that is the only way it can be done. They didn't want to submit to the European Court of Justice, but we accept that by allowing arbitration to solve issues between us, we accept that the outcome of that arbitration is binding. So yes, you can of course not be a judge in your own case, but in arbitration you come pretty close to that. But you have to mention the people that are in the arbitration. You cannot just pick A and B as you like. You have to make a list beforehand, well beforehand, which shows which people would be involved in an arbitration if it ever came to that. But the example I give hope is also to show that arbitration is pretty alive and fresh still. Mm-hmm. It's not a concept that has died with the years. It is there, and it is a necessary solution whereby a state except to be bound by an outside judgment. Mm-hmm. And that in itself is a big thing. I remember I was friends with the ambassador of Argentina here in The Hague. And one day I said, well, wouldn't it be a good idea to have sort of a mediation effort about the Falklands or the Malvinas in The Hague? And he said, yes, would be a good idea, but never ever do that in the Peace Palace. Mm. And that struck me because I had always thought that the Peace Palace would be a nice venue to have mediations as well. But it was clearly associated with judicial adjudication.
Interesting.
Mediation and the Peace Palace would not go well together. That should be done in a hotel somewhere far away. but that struck me as interesting.
It's very interesting. And this sort of like revolutionary act to agree to have to submit to a decision of a third party, I can't help but think that it is connected to our belief in, you know, rationality and the ability, you know, of a human being to sort of be impartial and not be political. And I think that this is connected to neutrality as well. So I think there are like many, many values that undergird this will of the state to agree to submit. I don't think the United States does not want to do that. I mean, even with the International Court of Justice, there's like the Connolly Amendment, and basically the United States will submit to the International Court of Justice when it thinks that it should.
The U.S. has been a party that accepted, say, as a general rule, accepted the competence of the court. But I think after the case with Nicaragua, they withdrew. And that happened to other countries. The French did the same. All the European nations are part of the system of the International Court of Justice, but not the French, because they felt aggrieved by Australia when they were criticized for doing nuclear tests in the Pacific. And you can see there the how political it is, and that it is not just a textbook or a theoretical line. It has very much to do with the way you conceive your external relations and what you think you can accept vis-a-vis the public opinion. What you can accept as an outside judgment. Just to go one step back to this Falkland discussion, I'm absolutely sure that neither Argentina nor the UK would ever agree to submit that matter to an outside judgment because it's too much entrenched in their national feelings. That's how I see it.
That's fascinating. That's a lot to think about. We have about, you know, like 8 minutes left. And so now's the time that I think we should start to wind down this fascinating conversation. I've learned so much. Thank you so much, Stephen, for sharing your expertise with us and our listeners. And just to sort of recap what we've done on the show, and then I'll open it up to anyone who wants to close out with final comments. We started talking about the Peace Palace and Stephen, your role as the director of the Carnegie Foundation, which, you know, oversees the Peace Palace and the numerous institutions that really have grown following the 1899 Hague Peace Conference. So you do have the Permanent Court of Arbitration. You have the Peace Palace Library. You have the Hague Academy of International Law. I think that began in 1923.
Yeah.
So yeah, after the Permanent Court of International Justice. So you have this like repository of all of these pieces of this normative framework that we've been talking about. So we've talked about a little bit of the history, and we've talked about a little bit the different mechanisms that were laid out in 1899, and we see them also expressed in the UN Charter today. And as we have mentioned, the International Court of Justice also, you know, meets in the Peace Palace. I'm just going to begin with my final comment, which is again about education. I said it earlier today. I'm gonna say it again. I always, you know, try to close with some, you know, historical anecdote about Bertha von Suttner and what she contributed. And I just want to underscore that and say she absolutely saw education as an essential piece of this. And this is why she did what she did in 1899. She had a salon. So we mentioned before that the press were not allowed in the plenary sessions. So she created a space where people could come and and discuss what the conference was doing. And she wrote about it in her Hague diary that was published in 1900. She was very aware of the Boer War. Like Randy said, she did not look at that as indicating a failure of the conference. On the contrary, she said the fact that this conference happened, that's it. And she wasn't the only one who said that. Like, the fact that this conference actually happened, that's it. Like, that's like, once that happens, that opens up the imagination. And we have seen throughout the years how that imagination keeps building.
Yeah.
So anybody else want their final comment? Now is your chance.
Yeah, I'll jump in. So from what we've talked about today, I'm trying to build this bridge in my mind between two categories. And in the process of like this wide scope of international settlement of disputes, I always think about like conflict resolution through the lens of human psychology. And like the prisoner's dilemma is something that people are familiar with, where, you know, some agent is responsible for making a decision and whether to cooperate or not. And, you know, as this scales up and things get more complex, there's more and more pressure to not cooperate. But, and so this is like a transition into a question that, you know, does it seem like in the long run, if everybody's actually cooperating, it's going to be the kind of net best case scenario for everyone, like the humans, or like the psychological literature seems to indicate does that metaphor seem to break down when we're talking about like peace and justice and not like game theory?
So, sure. I mean, we can just leave that open as a question for people to ponder.
Yeah.
I think it's a good question, and I'll just, you know, the welfare of people piece, that is, you know, we did not, although it was in the outline, it's my bad, but I neglected to mention the Tsar's rescript and the Count Muravyov's circular, which is like before the 1899 Hague Peace Conference is actually like convened. The idea has to be expressed, the idea, this vision. And so you have the, you know, Tsar Nicholas II of Russia expressing this vision of a different world. And that world is one in which the welfare of the people is taken to be paramount, and that states need to stop the arms race because that's really impacting the welfare and the creative potential and so forth. So I just want to connect like the sort of like, you know, best for all with like, there's a recognition that militarism and that way of solving disputes is not the best for all. I'll just say that.
Can I make two final comments?
Yes, please.
The first one is that I would like to mention and not miss the opportunity to say that the Carnegie Foundation is part of the wider cooperation of the Carnegie institutions. Mm. This is where we met, for instance, I think in New York at one of those. It has really been an eye-opener and also a basis of great friendship to be part of the network of the other Carnegie institutions. Mm-hmm. Like the one in New York, the corporation or the endowment or whatever. Now, on the question by Randy, on the point by Randy, I think that in the end, on the long term, the cooperation attitude must prevail. On the short run, it may be more difficult because you maybe do not enough for your country's interest if you allow outside parties to step in and solve the issues for you. But I'm a European, I'm in The Hague, and I'm part of the European Union. That was created after the Second World War. In Europe, the European nations have made the most terrible wars in 1418 and in 1445. And it was after that that they felt that never should this happen again. And they invested in cooperation in a European community that had supranational powers and that brought the parties together on a number of domains. And in fact, it has worked for 70 years. There has not been a war in Europe. And it's very, very unlikely that it will ever happen again because the national feelings have been extinguished in part by this form of cooperation. Now, I can see not everywhere can you create European unions, but it is an example to show that in the end, in terms of peace and justice, cooperation is really the line to follow.
And I just want to add to that, you know, we've been talking about like how long it takes these ideas to fully ripen and develop all the work that's needed. And you know, the idea of the European Union was expressed by the peace through law movement and at the international peace conferences by Victor Hugo was one of the persons advocating for the European Union in the mid 1800s. And, you know, it takes time for these ideas to sort of like, you know, ripen and establish themselves in people's consciousness. So anybody else, we're closing out, final thoughts, Taylor, go ahead.
Yeah, one thing that really resonated with me at the beginning of this talk was the idea of hope for a better future, like represented through the Temple of Peace and how Bertha von Suttner's work, Andrew Carnegie's donation, and the 1899 Peace Conference was really built for this hope. And I feel like as we've, you know, sort of rounded out this conversation, we've talked about, well, even with the occasional wars, there still are so many successes through arbitration, and we're building these institutions, and how the institution building involves, you know, education through for the public through, I guess, what was done in the visitor center, what's been done through the library, and what's been done really through the existence of the Peace Palace as a building. It draws people in. And even if it's not arbitration, the international institutions have, you know, proliferated. It started as the Permanent Court of Arbitration. Then we have now the International Court of Justice in addition to it. And there are all these different entities, even within the Peace Palace itself, that are really sort of building up this framework. And even if it's, you know, not arbitration, but it's mediation or conciliation, that states are actually looking, and we are on that path of individuals, you know, guiding states to look at force or other ways besides force to settle their disputes. Mm-hmm. And I think what really stood out to me in one of Stephen's last comments has been this idea that the European Union, you know, moved towards these institutions in light of war because they were so devastating, and states giving up and consenting to arbitration is very similar in that way because they know that war is going to cost them more. And I just think like it's really the red thread throughout this conversation has really stood out to me of just being like this idea of hope, you know, at the conference and how we really have made significant progress throughout all these actors and in history.
Mm-hmm. Thank you for that. And
yes, Michael. I will round us out. I just wanted to extend a huge thank you to you, Stephen von Hoogstraten, for joining us. I have thoroughly enjoyed coming to be aware of your knowledge, your work. I think you very much embody the moral energy that we have discussed lots on the show. I really appreciated your political literacy, especially in the international realm. I would love to have heard your thoughts on the happenings in Belarus with the whole political disputes that have been occurring since August. But I will save that for a future conversation. And it's been so awesome to finally be able to speak with you. Taylor, Randy, and Hope have sung your praise for as long as I've been a part of this show since the summer. So it's truly such an honor to get to speak with you. And I would just like to then extend an immense thank you to Hope, Randy, and Taylor being a part of this, joining this little gang of immense discussion and coming to know about so much in terms of international law and this very profound history has been truly one of the greatest moments of this very turbulent year for me. And I so appreciate your support, your knowledge that you have helped to bestow upon me. And I've grown a lot. Seriously, entering this year on January 1st, not like completely ignorant of all of these happenings. And then now being at a place of this year, slightly less ignorant, that is a huge victory for me personally. So no, I thank you all. And I hope you all have an amazing start to 2021.
Thank you, Michael. Thank you very much. I have three more hours and 25 minutes or so before the year starts.
All right. Well, we will like leave it there. And again, thank you so much, Stephen. It has been a pleasure to have you be a friend of yours since we met in 2013. And we're in a different world now, but the work continues. And part of this work is, keeping up these conversations and continuing the conversations. Yeah. And I think, the message of hope is quite relevant to where we are today. So let us begin. So Stephen, you'll have the last word, and then I'm gonna hit end and wish everybody happy New Year.
No, I have no more extra thoughts. I was struck by this idea of hope, that what is being done by the institutions supports a hope for a better world. I think I'll leave it at that, but I think it is true as well. Thank you.
Thank you, and Happy New Year.
Happy New Year to you all.
Bye bye.
Happy New Year.
Bye bye. Bye-bye.